Blog Talk Radio.
What is wrong with you people?
Activate.
Can you be quiet for one night?
Two, one.
What is gonna break the table tonight? Give it to them, and I'm gonna give it to you. They don't understand the whole thing.
Okay, my name is Edward L. Fairley.
Man up, man up.
This is my baby. Relationships is my passion, my love.
Everybody wants it. There's nobody in the world that does not want to feel wanted or special. I don't care who you are. Now that's something I'm willing to say is a term that everybody.
Out there, one of my close friends and brother, and of course Eddie's friend as well, brother. We got the one and only Mr. Hot Time Black is online with this topic, and I appreciate it.
Man up!
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Good evening. Good evening. How's everybody doing?
To tell it how I see it, because I've been on both sides of the coin.
Those who are checking the show, the Man Up Talk Show, as we try to build what we're doing in this movement. We got my brother, other brother here, Dow Harrington, and welcome to the show as another host, of course.
Man up! Man up!
Now, I appreciate smart. You gotta know in this game, man, it ain't enough.
When you meet people, you wanna know their knowledge. You wanna know their story. What's the backstory? What brought you to this day? And if you build something to help you to achieve that, it would be just totally different.
We are on deck. Wanna welcome everyone to the show. Listen to New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Virginia, North Carolina, Georgia, where I checked you out earlier. Once again, yours from Mr. Nas, and I want to send a
special...
I think all you men have nailed it, because the fact remains, we can't teach our younger men to become better men if we're being hypocrites. We're being hypocrites about what we're telling them to do. Has been done to me, and I have done them. So I'm speaking from experience, and I'm also speaking from being able to tell you that it's real.
Everybody has to have a core. There's something that drives me. There's something that is bigger than ourselves.
Are you kidding me? Did you really just come at me like that? You will be eliminating the people that just don't have no business coming in your direction in the first place by the way you carry yourself, the way that you speak, and everything like that. So all you're doing is eliminating and inviting the correct people in your life.
No. We want to hear the difference.
Where do y'all want to go with this? You're talking children. You're talking relationships. You're talking all kinds of things. And it blows my mind, man.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here. As many of you know, last March, when it was announced that I was no longer in the Black Muslim movement, it was pointed out that it was my intention to work among the 22 million non-Muslim Afro-Americans and to try and form some type of organization or create a situation where the young people, our young people, the students and others, could study the problems of our people for a period of time and then come up with a new analysis and give us some new ideas and some new suggestions as to how to approach a problem that too many other people had been playing around with for too long. And that we would have some kind of meeting and determine at a later date whether to form a black nationalist party or a black nationalist army. There have been many of our people across the country from all walks of life who have taken it upon themselves to try and pool their ideas and to come up with some kind of solution to the problem that confronts all of our people. And tonight we are here to try and get an understanding of what it is they've come up with. Also, recently, when I was blessed to make a trip or a pilgrimage, a religious pilgrimage to the holy city of Mecca, where I met many people from all over the world, plus spent many weeks in Africa trying to broaden my own scope and get more of an open mind to look at the problem as it actually is. One of the things that I realized, and I realized this even before going over there, was that our African brothers have gained their independence faster than you and I here in America have. They've also gained recognition and respect as human beings much faster than you and I. Just 10 years ago on the African continent, our people were colonized. They were suffering all forms of colonization, oppression, exploitation, degradation, humiliation, discrimination, and every other kind of nation. And in a short time, they have gained more independence, more recognition, more respect as human beings than you and I have. And you and I live in a country which is supposed to be the citadel of education, freedom, justice, democracy, and all of those other pretty sounding words. So it was our intention to try and find out what was our African brothers doing to get results so that you and I could study what they had done and perhaps gain from that study or benefit from their experiences. And my traveling over there was designed to help to find out how. One of the first things that the independent African nations did was to form an organization called the Organization of African Unity. The purpose of our organization of Afro-American Unity, which has the same aim and objective, to fight whoever gets in our way. To bring about the complete independence of people of African descent here in the Western Hemisphere and first here in the United States, and bring about the freedom of these people by any means necessary. That's our motto. The purpose of our organization is to start right here in Harlem, which has the largest concentration of people of African descent that exists anywhere on this earth. There are more Africans here in Harlem than exist in any city on the African continent, because that's what you and I are, Africans. The Charter of the United Nations, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Constitution of the United States, and the Bill of Rights are the principles in which we believe. And that these documents, if put into practice, represent the essence of mankind's hopes and good intentions, desirous that all Afro-American people and organizations should henceforth unite so that the welfare and well-being of our people will be assured. We are resolved to reinforce the common bond of purpose between our people by submerging all of our differences and establishing non-sectarian constructive programs for human rights. We hereby present this charter, number one, the establishment, The Organization of Afro-American Unity shall include all people of African descent in the Western Hemisphere. In essence, what it is saying, instead of you and me running around here seeking allies in our struggle for freedom, in the Irish neighborhood or the Jewish neighborhood or the Italian neighborhood, we need to seek some allies among people who look something like we do. And once we get their allies, it's time out for you and me to stop running away from the wolf right into the arms of the fox, looking for some kind of help. That's a drag. Number two, self-defense. Since self-preservation is the first law of nature, we assert the Afro-Americans' right to self-defense. The Constitution of the United States of America clearly affirms the right of every American citizen to bear arms. And, as Americans, we will not give up a single right guaranteed under the Constitution. The history of unpunished violence against our people clearly indicates that we must be prepared to defend ourselves, or we will continue to be a defenseless people at the mercy of a ruthless and violent racist mob.
Good evening, everybody. This is a very special Man Up Talk Show. Friday night, February the 21st, 2014. The Man Up Show is on the air. I am Big D Darrell Harrington, one of your co-hosts here this evening to share a very special evening with you. Hope everybody is well. Hope everybody is delighted to hear the message of one of the greatest civil rights leaders. Forget civil rights leaders. Let me correct that. Let me correct myself on that. One of the greatest human rights leaders of all time, Minister El Hajj Malik El Shabazz, better known as Malcolm X. Along the line with me tonight is also my main man, my brother from a different mother, Mr. Naz Wayne Holland is here. He's online. Naz, how you doing tonight, bro?
Now it's on. Now it's on, brother. I'm feeling good. I'm feeling inspired. I have that little Teflon Don thing going on. It's all good. I'm feeling good about myself, man. Feeling really good about my family. Feeling good about the progress. You know, I feel good. I feel blessed. Maybe that's the best way to say it. But without the blessings of God, and of course, respect to all our Muslim brothers and sisters that's tuned into the show, my sister as well, who is a Muslim, I want to say salam alaikum to you, my sister. I love you with all my heart, sis. Even though we grew up Christian, but you made your own decision to become Muslim and follow Allah, we still talk about it all the time behind the scenes. It's still one God, one love, and one creator. But that's my sister. She tuned on to the show, so I love you, sis. I just want to make sure I acknowledge her and also the Muslim brothers and sisters.
That's what it is. Because, you know, me too. My sister also has converted to Islam. So, I mean, it is just unlike. Also on the line with us is the one, the only, Edward L. Fairley. Eddie, how are you doing tonight, my brother?
I am peaceful. I'm in a peaceful reflection state, man. I'm great, man. I'm good. How y'all doing?
Feeling blessed, brother. I'm feeling good, man. I truly am. Not just saying I feel it. I feel good, man.
Well, it seems that the words of the night, for the brothers at least, is that we are in a very peaceful and reflective mood. We're blessed, and we acknowledge our blessings and where our blessings come from, and that's a wonderful thing. On with the show. Tonight's show is not only about a man's life, a man's journey, a man's walk, the acknowledgement of his death and the manner for which it came about, which is on this day in 1965, but his legacy and what that legacy has produced and is producing. Like I said, we're going in on the life of Malcolm Little, Detroit Red, Malcolm X, El Hajj Malik El Shabazz, and 1,001 other names that you could come up with for this great, true giant of our race, of our culture. I want everybody's reflections. I'm gonna start with you, brother, because I know that Brother Minister has meant a lot to you as well as all of us, so I'm gonna start with you, Ed.
As far as Malcolm X, he has played a huge role in my life. I was actually raised for a brief period in my life as Muslim. Most of my childhood, I was raised Muslim, actually. So I thank God for the Muslim religion. The Muslim religion has provided me with a lot of discipline in my learning or teaching through my mother. And because she was a Muslim when she raised me as a single parent mother before she converted from that religion, so she had her ex and everything, and it provided a lot of awareness and discipline, and I attribute that to my manhood, if you will, because I personally feel that the discipline and the strength that it gave my mother to move on with three children as a single parent mother and to raise a young boy to a man, it had a lot to do with the Muslim religion, and I thank God for it. I think everything happens for a reason, and I think that was a very intentional process in regards to my upbringing. I definitely read his book, and that actually caused a big shift in my thinking. I think I stated before in a previous Man Up talk show that it was from me. I think I saw the movie first, and I couldn't when that young Caucasian woman was so into his movement to where she walked up to him and asked what could she do to help his movement in hopes to contribute to or give more momentum or help to the cause. He looked at her just as plain, and he said nothing. Not nothing as in no words. He told her there's nothing that she's doing. He left it at that, and I couldn't. That scene really impacted me to the point where it caused me to question, like, what could cause a man to just hate a whole race like that? And from that, because I was so young when I saw the movie, so I didn't really grasp everything. Later on in life, I finally sat down and read the book, the biography of Malcolm X, and from there, though I never hated Caucasians, I understood why he hated Caucasians after reading his story. And because of that story, I never judged a person by their decisions again or their thought process. I just was more intrigued by what their story was to help to get to the point of feeling or acting or responding in the manner that they did, if that makes any sense. So because of his story, it helped me to not judge people but investigate people, if you will, instead of judging their actions. And I found that when you investigate or grow curious as to why people make the actions, and you actually intentionally try to find out why through questioning as opposed to getting emotional and judging them by the decision, you really find out how you might understand why they did what they did, which doesn't align with your decision making or your philosophies in life, and you might grow to respect their actions as opposed to judging them for them. So that is how much of an impact Malcolm X has made in my life.
That's right. That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. Now,
yes,
my brother.
Yes, sir.
Give us a little bit of what, you know, Malcolm's journey and his life has meant to you, and then I'm definitely going to do the same as soon as you're done.
It's not much I can say. I grew up in a time where, you know, I had an uncle, God rest his soul. He was FOI, the Nation of Islam. I didn't understand, but he was highly disciplined in how he carried himself. He kept always trying to talk to me when I was younger about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and this man called Malcolm X, you know, Brother Shabazz. I never understood. But as I got older, I started understanding why he walked the circle, where he carried himself the circle, where he just, then also some of the things that Malcolm X, Brother Shabazz would talk about. I guess it's a sense of pride, the sense of being accountable for itself and basically shine a light on our quote-unquote black community of needing to stand up for yourself. You know, he said it was okay to defend yourself. You know, I mean, yeah, his thought pattern has shifted and stuff like that, but he's never let go of his core principles. That impressed me so much about the man Malcolm X. And I also heard a speech by him, "Who Taught You to Hate Yourself?" Very powerful. I played the thing at least three or four times over. You know, why are we marginalizing or allowing other people to downplay who we are as black people? Why are we downplaying the struggles that we've been through? Oh, you guys been through this whole, it's okay. No, it's not all right. We can't forget where we came from. We can't forget about the struggle. We can't forget about those who struggled before us. It's okay to fight for what's right. I mean, he's instilled a lot of pride in me. Part of my family's instilled part of his teachings into me. And in some way, shape, or fashion, just a lot of who he was, the man, I guess got ingrained into my personality. I really don't back down too much. I don't say too much, but when I say something, I try to make it a substance. And I try to be a little bit more passionate than words, and that's what he was really all about. I mean, that's what I get from Malcolm X, brothers.
Right. That's what I'm talking about. I'm feeling that. I'm totally feeling that. Ask yours truly. I've been blessed to have a family who have been and are and raised their children to be aware of not only who you are, but whose you are, and to be proud of that fact, where you come from, who your people are, to hold your head up high with dignity, knowing that you are not better than anyone, never look down on anyone unless you're to help them up, but never think that you are beneath or below anybody, especially based upon color or creed or sexual orientation. None of that stuff has anything to do with the caliber of human being that you are. I was introduced to Malcolm X at a pretty young age. I would say that I would say about 8 to 10, somewhere in that area. At the time when I was introduced to Malcolm X, he wasn't the popular cult figure, which we could go in that in midst of conversation. He wasn't the popular cult figure that he is today. much similar to when he died. Some black folks thought that Malcolm was a little too controversial. Other black folks thought that, you know, he turned his back on his core principles and put himself in peril. Others from other races believed him to be a hate monger. What he was a giant amongst men, and very few had the vision to be able to see so. He was a man with great insight, blessed by God, to be able to see and understand our plight, and had the courage to be able to try to really get to the heart of the matter, really deal with the issues of that time. In spite of understanding that his very life was on the line, he knew who God was and what was most important. I mean, that to me is a testament to who he is. I mean, it's just a testament to me. To continue, Malcolm Little, born May 19th, 1925, Omaha, Nebraska, raised by his mother and his father at a young age. His father was a Baptist preacher who was a follower of Marcus Garvey. Because of his what whites perceived in Nebraska in the 1920s and 30s as radical behavior, Malcolm's father, Earl, was executed and killed. His mother would soon lose her mind, and her children all taken and separated and scattered, destroying the nucleus of their family. Malcolm, being put in foster care while in school, was asked what did he want to be when he grew up. He stated that he wanted to be a lawyer. He was told that being a lawyer is no job for a nigger. You should be something like a carpenter. From that point, something shut down in that young man. And he began to start to become wayward, taking odd jobs as a porter on the railway while in Boston, while associated with friends. He began a life of crime, petty theft. Him, his boy, his girlfriend, who happened to be a white woman at the time, and her sister, who also happened to be white at the time. In the midst of this, he gets arrested and sent to prison. The almost decade of time that he was in prison was unheard of for a crime of that offense, but some would say that the length of time he was in prison was based upon the fact that he, a black man, was laying with a white woman more than it was just the crime of a petty thief. Well, while in prison, he had discovered Islam. He had discovered the first stint of his life had ended, the beginning of a new chapter which would bring him national recognition through his era and be the linchpin that has given him this humongous legacy would start from that point on. That's the early story of Malcolm prior to the Nation of Islam. Eddie, from your recollection, from your readings, from your understanding of it, is there anything that I left out?
One thing that I think was big that I feel that you left out is that though his father was murdered, they wrote it as a suicide. yes. though he was tied up on a train. And also, with that being said and done, that caused the with that. I mean, personally, that is what caused the division of the family and the mom being going crazy because that insurance would his insurance was denied because it was marked a suicide, which in turn caused him not to receive any funds for the life insurance. So that I think that that was a serious experience that that actually caused a lot of the pain and anger and or hatred that, that grew inside him as well. But I think that's, I mean, that's pretty much covered. If you want to summarize it, I mean, we can't go the whole thing, but yeah, that's pretty much all the big things. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, outside of drugs, the drug use and stuff like that.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, it was, it's a story that a lot of us in certain parts, a lot of us cannot relate to certain parts, but there's always something in other people's story that we can see, whether it is being in a broken home, whether it is having people crush your dreams at an early stage and being rebellious to that thought process, making wrong decisions, and watch how God in life moves you, even in your hour of despair. I believe that when Malcolm sat there in that courtroom in Massachusetts and he was told that, you know, that he was going to jail for 20 years, I'm pretty sure he didn't see that as a good day. But if it wasn't for him being incarcerated, would he ever have become gone under the tutelage of Elijah Muhammad? Would he ever been made, you know, to become Minister Malcolm X? And like I said, would that journey had begun if it hadn't been for everything else that preceded it? Most of it, one would definitely say, was tragic. One tragedy after another tragedy after another tragedy, leading to a culmination, which to me is a is an interesting hypothesis. Now, to like to continue on, he would go to prison. He would then be introduced to Islam while he's in prison, in which he became associated with Elijah Muhammad. Elijah Muhammad became aware of Malcolm, aware of how smart he was, how gifted he was, what a great orator he was. Having him directly underneath him while in Detroit once he got out of prison, and then in 1958 sending him to Manhattan, sending him to Harlem to open Mosque 7, which is the beginning of what others would call the legend of Malcolm X, the Nation of Islam years, where he was the official spokesperson for the Nation of Islam. He is the creator and innovator of Muhammad Speaks, the Nation of Islam newspaper. And he would go from state to state, country to country, college to college, and lecture, whether it be on television, whether it be, you know, in front of, let's say, college audiences all across this country to educate on the plight of the black man and the struggles and the differences in the civil rights movement. Eddie, can you enlighten us and share with us your opinion on the differences between Malcolm, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and the way the American black Muslim in the Nation of Islam looked at the condition of the black man in the late 1950s and 1960s, let's say in contrast to the NAACP and SNCC and Martin Luther King Jr. and the nonviolent civil rights movement that was going on simultaneously in the same era.
What I feel the difference was?
Yeah, the contrast, yeah.
The contrast, I would say that Martin was for equality amongst all people and building that equality amongst all the people. Malcolm, and even the NAACP, even though the NAACP by definition is not supposedly about black people, or the focal point is supposedly not for black people, it's about bringing equality to African Americans. But their approach is more just planting a seed of pride amongst black people and giving us a sense of purpose and wisdom and character, and it's truly a transformation of how we a paradigm shift, if you will, of how we think about ourselves and actually just trying to get us to be productive and producers of our own and realizing who we were in Africa, if you will, in the sense of kings and queens, and being prideful and, I guess, resurrecting that whole thought process and being that we came from through our ancestors. So it was more of, okay, we need to get our people straight. Matter of fact, a good example would be Brother Brent Oz. His philosophies align a lot with the Muslim concepts as well as the NAACP. We need to get our black people straight and help us grow from within. And when we get ourselves together, then we can talk
about integration.
Yes. So Martin was, no, we need to integrate and grow together as a unit, or unify ourselves and grow together and consider each other equals, and we won't have to get ourselves together and then come together. So and the Nation of Islam was, no, first of all, we don't, our self image is jacked, where we have been mentally fooled, if you will, and tricked into being less than who we really are. And with that, we need to retrain ourselves, recreate ourselves, and recognize who we are and stand in that and walk in that and show how powerful we are as a people. So then they will realize who we are, and then they will be forced to give us equality because of, just a good example, the Million Man March. That was more so to get a million people away from working to kind of show America how valuable we are as African-American just males. Not being at work and everything shutting down for that one day because black people were not doing anything. That was more of, though it was more for uplifting and empowering African-Americans, the intent was to show how much of an effect we have on the United States of America. So it was more so we need to unify ourselves, grow mentally, and be aware of who we are, and become kings and queens of the United States in the way we carry ourselves, with character and pride and intellect, and from there show our value, which in turn will force us to have power through us giving ourselves power mentally and within, and it just forcing itself to bleed outwardly. So that's pretty much my take on the contrast.
Brother Aki, I don't think I could have said it any better myself. What I'm going to do right now is, because Naz brought up a good point in a good reflective speech where, you know, which echoes what you just said, Ed. It was Malcolm X, and who taught you to hate yourself? So we're going to listen to this for a brief second, and then we're going to go into Malcolm, his years with the Nation of Islam, then the eventual split with the Nation of Islam, which led to the death, and then we're going to talk about his legacy.
All right.
First, yeah, hear me? Yeah, Eddie? Okay.
Let's
so
do
we're
it.
Going to go into Who Taught You to Hate Yourself right now.
Who taught you, please, who taught you to hate the texture of your hair? Who taught you to hate the color of your skin to such extent that you bleach to get like the white man? Who taught you to hate the shape of your nose and the shape of your lips? Who taught you to hate yourself from the top of your head to the soles of your feet? Who taught you to hate your own kind? Who taught you to hate the race that you belong to? So much so that you don't want to be around each other. No, before you come asking Mr. Muhammad, does he teach hate, you should ask who yourself, who taught you to hate being what God gave you. We teach you to love the hair that God gave you. Here you way out in the middle of the ocean, can't swim, and you worried about someone that's in the bathtub and can't swim. We don't steal, we don't gamble, we don't lie, and we don't cheat. And that also deprives the government of revenue. Because you can't get into a whiskey bottle without getting past the government seal. You can't open a deck of cards without getting past the government seal. Here's a white man makes the whiskey and then puts you in jail for getting drunk. He sells you the cards and the dice and puts you in jail when he catches you using them. So he's against us because we fix it where he can't catch you anymore. We take the dice out of your hands and the cards out of your hands and the whiskey out of your head. The most disrespected person in America is the black woman. The most unprotected person in America is the black woman. The most neglected person in America is the black woman. And as Muslims, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us to respect our women and to protect our women. And the only time a Muslim really gets real violent is when someone goes to molest his woman. We will kill you for our woman. I'm making it plain, yes. We will kill you for our woman. We believe that if the white man will do whatever is necessary to see that his woman gets respect and protection, then you and I will never be recognized as men until we stand up like men and place the same penalty over the head of anyone who puts his filthy hands out to put in the direction of our women.
Yeah, right there was the words of Minister Malcolm X, I would say said 1960, 1961, the official spokesman for the Nation of Islam and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad at that time. Eddie, could you hear the differences in the text and the vitriol, the venom, the passion, the awareness of Brother Minister from the Any Means Necessary speech in 1964 and this one in 1960?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can hear the drastic difference in his approach and the way he spoke. he sounds more confident. And I just, if you sat and listened to that, why wouldn't you want to be a Muslim? That's the way I look at it. If you were part of listening to that, and you started comparing and listening, why wouldn't you? Like, why wouldn't you want to sign up for that? In his presentation, we're here to protect you. We're here to help you. We're here to grow you. We're here to see you the way you should be seen. For those people who are in that room who question the way that they look, my lips, yeah, I do talk. People do talk about my lips. People do talk about my nose. And he's telling you that that's beauty or you know, we will protect you. We need to fight for you. Why wouldn't you want to be a part of that? I thought, and I still feel that the Muslims' approach to recruitment was absolutely awesome. Absolutely awesome. I oftentimes envy them in that regard because I think the Christian faith is really lacking in that area. I mean, look where they meet and recruit for most of their men is in the prison system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, they're meeting people where they are and pulling them out of their bad situations, and they are helping and growing people. And that's the best way I could put it.
Absolutely, brother. You got to meet them. You got to meet somebody where they are. That's it. The Bible even says, it says, come as you are. You don't
say that way. Yeah, don't say that way, no.
You know, I don't care how messed up you are coming in the door. Everybody here is messed up to one extent or the other. So,
and look how he sold that, man. Excellent salesperson. I apologize. I studied marketing and all kinds of, you know, sales and everything like that. Listen to how he uses words. Words are so powerful, and they're so he's so intentional. Like, okay, we take this now, you know, you're already going to have some feedback or some pushback. All right, you talking about taking my liquor or taking my drinks and stuff away, but look how he put it. We're going to take the drinks from you. We're going to get you to stop doing that so that they can stop using that to get you in jail or hitting you up. So it's like, dang, you know, I do hate to give up my drink, but you are right. They probably gave it to me so they could set me up. It was so strategic, and it tapped into emotion, and it attacked the logic, and it's just so great. I love orators. And so just to listen how great that was written and expressed is just, you hear me, I'm pacing through my house listening and talking about this as I speak. So it was just great. It was great. Wonderful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like I said, I mean, the man was a genius. In this speech, which that says, Sierra 1960,
mm-hmm.
he is representing the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He is representing the Nation of Islam. He's not necessarily speaking on behalf of himself.
That is correct. Or, and honestly, if you dig a little deep, he's not necessarily speaking on the behalf of the Muslim faith either.
No.
Unfortunately, he was speaking in. Yeah. So it's the story, if you really unpack it, which I hope we do today, it's such a sad, a powerful, it's a story with so many mixed emotions, and I really feel sorry for him just reflecting on it because it's some serious betrayal. If you listen to how he spoke so highly of him, so can you imagine once he realized that this man was lying, and after he just said to those people, we don't lie, so I'm not going to get ahead of you. I'm going to stop talking because I can start unfolding this whole thing, man.
Brother, as you can tell, I've been doing it bit by bit. I'm sort of going there. We ain't there yet. We're almost there.
Go ahead.
We're almost there. Not much. Almost there. But I feel your enthusiasm. I'm enthusiastic.
I'm pausing.
Thank you. You know, you're ready to get toward the end of the ride. Hold on. We're still at the middle of the ride. I mean, we still got an hour to go.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Hold up. All right. But, like I said, to hear the passion and the and the power in what this man has to say. Inspired by God, but also inspired by his father figure, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, a man that he would die for, a man that, you know, who changed and cultivated his life. He was nothing more than a two-bit hood and hustler in prison, not just physically in a bar, in a room with a cell and bars, in, you know, bars where the windows are, but his mind was in prison. His whole state of existence, his whole state of being was in bondage. It's been in bondage from the time that his daddy was murdered and his mama went crazy and they took him and ripped him from his family and put him in this situation that from that point forth, he had been in bondage. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad, in his estimation, at this point, at this juncture in his life, had freed him from it. He had awakened him. It's like, okay, for those of you and those of us who are Christian, do you remember when you were born again? Do you remember when you received the good news that Jesus Christ died for your sins and your salvation, and you took it to heart? Not that you just intellectually understood the words, but in your heart, you understood it to be true for you. Some people call people, when they become born again, Jesus fanatics, because they're always telling you about Jesus. Jesus, 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 Jesus. You know, don't do that. You're going to go to hell because Jesus, 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 Jesus. Well, really, why they're going Jesus, 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 Jesus is because they're so enthusiastic because they understand what Jesus has done for them in their life. It becomes a personal testimony, hence their excitement over it. They're not trying to browbeat you over the head, even though it might seem like they are. They're just enthusiastic over the word. Same general principle applies in this situation for Malcolm. He just found out that, you know, we've had the power all along, my brothers.
We have been
lulled into this false sense of security, and we have been asleep and dormant for far too long. Now, you got to remember, the first militant in his life wasn't Elijah Muhammad. It was his dad. His father was a follower of Marcus Garvey. And if you go to the turn of the 20th century, that Jamaican was crazy. Everybody but that Jamaican was nuts. He was telling brothers, it's time for us to gather up here, join this organization, and we're about to bolt out of this joint and go back to where we came from. Lunacy. Only people that were stealing Marcus Garvey, funny enough, was the Klan. The Klan was totally behind Marcus Garvey. Going, dang, Skippy. Take the rest of them niggas and go about your business. We'll help you do so. And Marcus Garvey didn't see anything wrong with that at all and said, you know what? We don't want to be here. You don't want us here. Let's make this work. Well, Malcolm's father, Earl, also felt that, yes, that we needed to be amongst ourselves. We needed to empower ourselves, love ourselves. And this is something that was the seed that was planted in his son. But the person who cultivated that crop was Elijah Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, that seed laid dormant for like 25 years. Before Elijah Muhammad came by with some water to make it work. So now you have this man who is awake and alive, and he is telling everybody who is willing to listen. And because he's such a dynamic orator, everybody's calling him out to talk to him. Now, the pseudo-intellectuals, you know, who is this Negro with no formal education? We'll invite him to Cambridge. We'll invite him to Yale. We'll invite him to Oxford. And, you know, we will see who he really is. Well, they invited our brother, and our brother wowed them at every turn. Every single turn. Everywhere that brother went, all he did was turn heads. Left, right, up, down. I mean, you can fight with him all, you can argue with him all day. But my brother's decorum, the madder they got, the calmer he got. The redder they got, the more golden glistening that he became. It's just rocking. During this time period, now, like I said, you got to understand, the country is in a state of flux. Like I said, there are sit-ins in Selma. There are churches being bombed in fire and being set on fire. There are nonviolent demonstrations going on all throughout the South. Dr. King and his philosophy is based, once again, both men were heavily affected by their fathers.
Mm-hmm.
Both of their fathers were Baptist preachers. Martin Luther King Sr., though, did not meet of the same fate as Earl Little or Malcolm or Martin, for that matter. He got to have his nuclear family. He was brought up under the guidelines of the gospel, and the gospel was the chief influence in Martin's life. Martin's role models was his father, Mahatma Gandhi, and Jesus, Mahatma Gandhi, and his dad.
Mm-hmm.
Those were his chief influences. So in the civil rights era, in the civil rights movement at that time, it was more, let's say, palatable for a Negro to be talking about nonviolence than by we going to do this by any means necessary. And the funny thing I always thought about this, and Eddie, share your opinion about this with me. The key word is by any means necessary. That doesn't mean that, you know, I got to take a gun and shoot you. That's the only way I'm going to get this done is to take you out. Mm-hmm. What it means is that the door is open to all solutions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're not even talking about taking the road of least resistance. What we're talking about is that the door is completely open to all alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that, you know, there's no going to be any situation where I'm going to take up arms and defend me or my loved ones. I never said that. What I said was, is that we will come to this solution, you know, to be treated like a man, to be treated like a human being in this society, in this place, by any means necessary. One of the most powerful statements I ever heard in my entire life. It resonates with me to this day that there is nothing that I will not do in order for me and my people, not just myself, not me, when I say me, not just me personally. I'm talking about me, my brother. I'm talking you. I'm talking Naz. I'm talking anyone. Not even based, and by this point with Malcolm, it wasn't even based on color. But I'm jumping ahead of myself here, jumping way ahead of myself. Let me back up some. This brother at this point in his life is totally, totally committed to the nation of Islam. I mean, even to the likes of converting one Cassius Clay, one Mr. Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he is right now at the height of his popularity within the Nation of Islam. He's at the height of his notoriety worldwide. Everybody knows by this point who this man is. But with success comes jealousy. In most circumstances, with success comes jealousy. Never in any speech that you can come up with during that time period have you ever heard Malcolm say that he was representing himself. He was representing on behalf of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam. Every speech, everywhere, from sea to shining sea. But you have people who are jealous of this man's walk, jealous of this man's talk, jealous of this man's notoriety, wishing that they had this notoriety. But, you know, but what can you do? You know, this brother is out here on this level. We can't touch him ourselves. But, you know, Minister Muhammad, I don't know, Malcolm's head is getting too big. He seems to be overstepping his boundaries. Whispers start to go about on one side of it. And then on the other side, while Malcolm is doing the works and the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, whispers come from Chicago that not just one secretary, but two secretaries of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad were impregnated by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Could you imagine the person that you believe in the most, who has changed and cultivated your life, who has taught you and has expressed how we are supposed to live, not just how I'm supposed to live, but how we are supposed to live. This is what we do, and this is how we do it. This is what must be done, and yet doesn't do it. That, to me, is just absolutely, that is absolutely horrifying to me. But as we continue on with this, we gotta bring our brother Tom on here. Tom, brother, talk to me. How are you doing tonight, my brother? Tom.
Yes, Tom. Brother.
My brother, that's what I'm talking about. I was starting to become concerned.
What?
We are going in and we are talking about the life, the times, the assassination, and most importantly, the legacy of Malcolm X. Tom, give us your thoughts and your opinions on Brother Minister before we continue on.
Well, you know, one of the things that I always respected most about Malcolm X was his transformation through his lifetime, going from, you know, early Malcolm, who wanted to fit in just like every other, you know, African-American at the time, to finding the Nation of Islam and being so radical, and then seeing sort of the truth about America's racism and how America is, America's racism is the problem, not just all white people, but America, you know, the system that we have here. And then when you get to the end of his life, like every great martyr out there for us, it was because they were starting to hit a real issue. And that real issue is that the system's broken. That this, you know, it's not just about race. It's about money. It's about class. It's about protecting the haves and the have-nots. And as soon as you start getting there, you saw Martin get killed. You saw Malcolm. You know, that's when it happens. And seeing that transformation through his life is powerful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Very well said. Very well said indeed. Couldn't say it much better myself. Where we were in the discussion of his life was Syria 1964. Secretaries from the Nation of Islam are impregnated. They're saying that the father of their children is the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. We talked about how this man was the central figure in the awakening of Malcolm X, is the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and yet now you are faced with a level of betrayal. You told me that this is what we're supposed to be. You told me this is what we're supposed to do. You told me how we are to carry ourselves. You told me to tell these people this is what we do. And you go and you do what? And I have to really just that whole concept to me is mind-blowing. To try to put myself in his shoes of, I'm totally drinking the Kool-Aid here, completely. I'm all in. All in. All my money is in the middle of the table. I'm betting on your hand completely. And then I find out that you only have a pair of twos. Yeah, I'm a certain kind of way. I'm flipped out to a certain kind of extent. Then the assassination of JFK happens. They ask Malcolm his opinions of it. He says, as a farm boy, I've never been upset when the chickens come home to roost. And in this case, this is the United States chickens coming back to roost for one of its own. And as a farm boy, I can never be upset about chickens coming home to roost. Maybe not one of the best statements he's ever made, but it was used to be the excuse to silence Malcolm within the Nation of Islam based upon the fact that Malcolm's discontent with Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm's popularity within society as he's becoming more and more popular. Mike Wallace in 60 Minutes interviews, going to Oxford, going to Harvard, going to Yale, Brown, other higher institutions of learning, television shows in the knot. The more and more popular he's getting, the more and more disillusioned with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam Malcolm is getting, the more and more hostile the situation is getting. Eddie or Tom, am I pretty much painting this accurately?
Pretty much, it's pretty accurate from this end, man. Sadly accurate.
Eddie, let me ask you this. Okay. Have you ever been, well, actually, no. Actually, I can, you know, I almost want to dummy smack myself before I even ask the question because I already know the answer. Eddie, how does it, you and Malcolm have a
parallel. A similar story. You have no idea. You have no idea how identical our stories are.
I was about to dummy smack myself as I thought about the question as it was about to come out my mouth. So you ain't got to slap me, brother. I kind of slapped myself on that one. But I want you to share with our listening audience the parallels in being betrayed by the one that you feel that you should be able to trust over all. How does that work on you and work at you? And how do you rise to a higher level from it?
What's interesting about this is it wasn't that betrayal that impacted me the way that Malcolm was betrayed. And I thank God for that, because his betrayal came later, so late in life for him, where yeah. mine came early in life. My betrayal actually came from my mother. So mm-hmm. I was accustomed to that type of betrayal, and I grew from that. But it was devastating. And just to make it brief, my betrayal came from my mother, because my mother was by everything, and she had told me, you know, moms and parents are the ones that say, you know, don't do drugs and drugs are bad and all this stuff. And I found out that she was doing drugs. So I asked her, I heard through the grapevine she was doing drugs. So I asked her, was she doing drugs? And she looked me dead in my face and she said, no, I'm not doing drugs. I would never do drugs. And I took her at her word and just was like, well, whoever told me, they lied. My mom would never do that. But then I eventually came home early one day. She didn't hear me, and she was in a room with her friends, and the door was cracked, and I saw my mother sniff some coke. And from that moment, actually probably to maybe 3 years ago, I had told myself that I would never trust another person again. Never. And that really shifted my life, because my mentality was, if you can't trust your mother, you can't trust anybody.
Mm.
If you cannot trust your own mother, who can you trust? And that caused so much turmoil and strain in so many relationships, because it was easy for me to love, but trust is the hardest word that you could ever get to come out of my mouth. That's something that mm-hmm. it takes, and it's crazy. My wife is in the bedroom shaking her head. Yes. The T word is such a huge word for me to use. Love is easy. I love everyone. But that T word is like, I love you. But so I say all that to say this because I'm going somewhere with this, believe it or not. When my father did what he did 3 years ago, I didn't have trust in men like that, or that dependency in men. And I personally feel that that was the transition in Malcolm X's life I think that's when he began to have a relationship or build a relationship with God. So I think that was a great experience for him, just like it was a great experience for me, because I no longer trusted man from my mother, but I always went to God. And my relationship began with God from me being devastated by my mom. And I think the same thing happened with Malcolm, because that devastation caused him to shift his thought process, which he should have never put all of his faith and trust in man in the first place. And he began to build his relationship directly with God. And I think, but it's such a devastating, and it's really hard to explain that feeling. I mean, I'm getting teared up now thinking about it, like when I saw my mother do that. And that is just the worst feeling to know that you would have done anything for that person. You took them at their word, and that you believed everything that they ever told you, and you felt that you were who you were because of that person, and you just pretty much gave all the credit and everything to that person, and that ruined me for a short period of time. It ruined me. Ruined me. But from there, like I said, I stopped trusting men, actually never trusted men again. And up until, like I said, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and I'm talking right now from being married almost 10 years to the point where I finally, like I said, about 3 years ago, when I told my wife that, you know what, I trust you. And I'm talking because I was married for probably about 7 years then, I didn't trust my wife wholeheartedly. It's like I can't put anything past anybody. I don't know what, you know, I don't know. So my mentality was always, I expected the worst. So you can't hurt me if I expect the worst. It's a terrible way to live. Anybody that really knows me knows I don't never get excited about anything. That's why if you ever heard me say anything good about myself, Signature just gets so happy because she knows that I always expected the worst. Because mentally it's like, okay, I'll either gain or break even. That's the way I live my life. I played it safe. I'll either gain or get a bonus or break even. What do I mean by that? If you tell me something's going to happen because of so much disappointment I've had in my life, I never believed that it would happen. So if it didn't happen, that was already my expectation. But if it did happen, oh, my goodness, that is a bonus. But you can never disappoint me, or I can never be lower than where I was because I never expected anything in the first place. I only trusted me and God.
Not, brother, no. I understand. Jeez. And, but, you know, answers, like, be able to look into Malcolm's ability to look through this. Like I said, he is horrified. And, I mean, it's probably until, like, Honorable Elijah Muhammad's son, Wallace, you know, came to him, you know, with the said women and like, you know, yeah, this is true. Yeah, here they are. Yeah, it's all true. There's no mistaking in this. This is what has happened. And him coming to, you know, him being silenced and the whispers and the jealousy over Malcolm's notoriety, and finally in March of 64, Malcolm leaving the Nation of Islam, saying, you know, that it is gone as far as it can. I mean, could you imagine the thing that you have dedicated from 1952 to 1964, 12 years of your life, you have been constantly on the grind, 100% all in. And now you've just said it is gone as far as it's going to go. I'm done. I'm out. I'm through. I'm not done being a Muslim. I will always be a Muslim. But I'm done in the Nation of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
That is just absolutely powerful. But that leads us to El-Hajj Malik al-Shabazz. This is where this is that conversion period. The last is not even a full year, funny enough, because, you know, this is in March of 1964. He would, like I said, he died on Sunday afternoon, the 21st of February, today, in 1965. So this other transformation, this other metamorphosis happened in little less than a year, which to me is amazing. You think it was a lot more time than that, but it wasn't. You know, he leaves, he forms Muslim Mosque Incorporated for the religious aspect of what he wanted to do. He started, you know, the Organization for African American Unity, you know, for his Pan-Africanism, for his understanding of not civil rights, but human rights, the right of all African descendants across the globe, not just African descendants here in America, because in his pilgrimage to Mecca, in his time that he got to spend in Africa, it was a eye-opening awakening. It is able to see, you know,
brothers, real true brothers, and real true sisters. But the brothers and the sisters aren't just brothers and sisters because they happen to have similar hue. Because some of them didn't. There were some as blonde-headed and blue-eyed as they could be, but they were no less brothers and sisters to him. They brought him, you know, into their home. They shared meals. They laughed. They joked. They were all a part of the same struggle. Yet, you don't look like me. This, for Malcolm, after, you know, you have 12 years of white devil this, white devil that. White devil this, white devil that. To standing beside a man and you're eating from the same dish, drinking from the same cup, on the same floor mat, praying to the same God, and reveling in the rapture of that same God together as brothers. Awesome. Ain't nothing else to say on that from my perspective than it being awesome. So he comes back to America with a sense of passion and fire and, you know, ready to do great things, ready to do great works. And this is where the story, Yellow, changes again. Tom, is there, what, can you elaborate and go further on your feelings or your thoughts about his conversion from Malcolm X, the Nation of Islam, and the doctrine of what the white man in America means to the struggle of the Negro in America, to the awakening of El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz in understanding that color is nothing more than a diversion. It's about the attention of the heart of the individual.
Yeah. Oh, wow. You know, since you say that, I was thinking, talking to someone earlier, and we were talking about racism outside of America and how some people don't believe that, you know, racism exists in Europe or wherever. And it's like, well, no, no. We're still black everywhere. I made this interesting comparison a while ago. It's like, if it's not going to be race someplace, it's going to be class, it's going to be social status or financial have and have not. But there's always going to be someone on the wrong end of the justice ladder. And I think that Malcolm X tripped to Mecca when he really saw something else. That was the beginning of that transformation you asked about. That was when he saw the strength of unity, passion, faith, so much. And then coming back to America after you know, to have, I can't even imagine what living then was like to begin with. I can't imagine that. But then to see something that you thought couldn't exist in process someplace else, that has to change your life. Like, just imagine right now, I'm even going to dumb it down. Like, imagine right now that all you know is, you know, there's always going to be unemployment, and then you go to some country where there's no unemployment, everyone's got a job. And has a big, you know, decent standard of living, and then you're just like, wait, this can exist? That's when your life is going to change. And I think that was what happened to him. And that brought you from, you know, Redick and Malcolm to Al-Haj, Malik Al-Shabaab.
Yep, that, Tommy, you pretty much hit the head on the nail. Now we get to the point of what today is, what today commemorates, February 21st. Well, now, before we do that, he comes back to America. On during this time, you got to remember, Malcolm, as renowned as he was and flying all over the world and speaking here and speaking there, he wasn't a rich man.
Mm-mm.
Much like Christ. Christ traveled all over. But Christ didn't have a home of his own or a bed to truly call his own. The house that Malcolm, his wife Betty, their four children, and Betty's pregnant with two children all along the way, that house was owned by the Nation of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Malcolm and Betty didn't own their house in Queens. They had to go to court to get an injunction because the Nation of Islam was suing Malcolm and Betty to evict them from that house. During this time period, February 1965, Malcolm and them lost the case and then they filed an appeal. They're receiving death threats at the home The famous picture of Malcolm X looking at the window with the AK-47 in his hand. All this is during this time period. On Valentine's Day, Sunday, February 14th of 1965, they firebombed the house and burned the house to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Malcolm sends Betty and the children off to a undisclosed location separate from him because he's fearful of his children and his wife, his pregnant wife, being caught in a crossfire.
Mm-hmm.
But he has a scheduled speech for the Audubon Ballroom Sunday afternoon, February 21st, 1965, for the Organization of African American Unity. They ask him to cancel it, postpone it. He says, no, we have to go on. We have to move forward. He goes on stage roughly about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. In the midst of, with his wife and four of his children in the front, a commotion. There's about 400 people in the Audubon Ballroom on that day. And a commotion breaks out in the back, towards the back, where a man yells, "Get your hands out my pocket, nigga." Malcolm steps up to the front and asks everybody to cool it. "Brothers, calm down. It's going to be all right. Brothers, calm down." A brother runs up to the front of the stage with a sawed-off shotgun and shoots Al-Haj Malik Al-Shabazz in the middle of his chest, blowing him back onto the back of his head, laying prone on the ground, where two other men, one man for certain is Talmadge Hayer, comes up and proceeds to unload two handguns into the torso, legs, and shoulders of Malcolm X until he's dead. If it wasn't for the fact that one of Malcolm's bodyguards had a gun, because Malcolm didn't want guns in the Audubon Ballroom, and he also didn't want them to frisk anyone coming into the Audubon Ballroom, because he thought if people were frisked, they wouldn't feel safe. And he wanted his brothers and sisters to know that this is a place of safe. This is a safe haven. You can come here and be safe. So you don't have to. You don't have to do it. Yeah, this is even a tough one for me. Even just thinking about it and talking about it. Even though I wasn't born at the time. This week I was blessed enough to spend time at the Malcolm X and Betty Shabazz Center, where the Audubon Ballroom was, and, well, to a certain extent still is. And to be able to see the spot where all this happened and all this transpired, to be literally standing in the exact location where it happened, and to talk about it at this time and reflecting on it at this time is personal. To say it plainly, it's personal. This man who is responsible for the Nation of Islam going from an organization of thousands to an organization of about 100,000. All because of the works of this man. The awakening and dawning of a different answer for the ills and the plights of the African-American person in America in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s, still to this day, the legacy that this man left behind, it ended on behalf of three gunmen. As I said, Talmadge Hayer, or known as Thomas Hagen, got shot in the leg. And then after he got shot in the leg trying to leave, that crowd beat him down for all intents and purposes. He got beat down. He got saved by the New York City Police Department, and he was arrested. So there's no doubt, and that's the gunman that stayed in prison just up to a few years back. He wasn't even, like, fully paroled until 2010. Like, the other two dudes were out of jail by, like, the late 70s. But that one didn't get out of jail until 2010. And I think it's because everybody knows, like, categorically, you know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that he is one of the gunmen, without a doubt. Because the other two gunmen, which is Norman 3X, allegedly, or Thomas 15X, he says that neither one of them were the other two gunmen, but a jury found them guilty of it anyway. And like I said, both dudes were in jail until like the late 70s, where Mr. Hare, who's now Muhammad Abdul Aziz, he was released in 2010. That's the end of the mortal life of Malcolm X. His viewing was at Harlem's Unity Funeral Home from the 23rd to the 26th of February of that year. His funeral was at Faith Temple Church of God in Christ in Harlem. Over 1,000 people went to his funeral. And like I said, that was the end of his mortal life. Like I said, his eulogy was done by Ozzie Davis. Everybody is, you know, I'm pretty sure a lot of us have heard Ozzie Davis's eulogy of Malcolm. But what I would like to talk about now for, you know, the next couple of minutes, and, you know, is the, that was the death. That's the culmination of his life and his life journey. But let's talk about what we believe his legacy is. But before we go into that, we would like to bring on our first lady of the Man Up Show, Miss Signature Black. Siggy, how you doing tonight, darling?
You guys, hi. Anytime you delve into the life of Malcolm or Martin, it takes you there. I truly enjoyed this show.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
It's been moving. You guys have me in tears. You have me in tears because I'm doing that Facebook thing, and it's taking me back when I first heard about him. And I think about the fact that when I first heard about him, my mom and my dad were the ones that talked about him, and they realized they weren't talking about him in school at the time. Yes, I'm dating myself. And that the movement and everything, and my mom and my dad were those people where you go to church, and they didn't care what church you went to, but you needed to learn about other religions so you could open yourself up to that much more understanding. And it was listening to Malcolm's speeches, it was listening to what this man had to say that made me think it's okay to think outside the box.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay for me to think things a little differently. It's so okay for me to be me and to decide that maybe that's not right, and it's okay to speak against that's not right. He is a powerful, was a powerful man. His legacy lives on. I'm glad you guys did this show. I'm speechless right now. I'm speechless because I'm listening to the eulogy in the other ear, and I got to go. I got to turn it off. Okay, go ahead.
Right.
I'm good. Great day.
There.
Guys.
Wow, I was just listening to that. Hey, Steve.
Hey.
So, you know, that was deep. I mean, I think this whole show has been. And it's interesting. I was talking to a friend a couple, you know, before the show about Malcolm White. First.
Well,
you know, it was funny for us. I didn't really get to understand him until later in life, and it was the bullet, the ballot, or the bullet was the speech that that brought me around. That was the speech that, yeah, to put it plain. I think it's be said that young people are just fed up right now, and there's a boiling point. Those same message, that same message resonates today.
Guys and gals, we have a caller on the line, Brittany from East Orange, New Jersey. Brittany, welcome to the Man Up Show. What do you have to say about this great man and this wonderful topic?
Yes, first let me just say thank you and good evening to everyone.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Oh, what I have to say is Malcolm has always resonated with me because he is such a pillar of respect, and he should be a pillar of respect in the community, especially amongst these young boys, because he was the epitome of manhood.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't saying, a lot of people who don't give Malcolm X enough credit think otherwise, but he wasn't saying, I'm going to be violent, I'm going to come in and burn down your buildings and pillage your neighborhoods. He was saying, listen, I'm a man just like you. If you strike my woman, I'm going to do something about that and strike you back. I have to protect my household as a man. And it's always just been very interesting to me because he was a man who treated his wife well, took care of his household, and thought that his community should be treated equal. I always saw him and Martin as like the lion and the lamb, the offense and the defense. But he's just always has touched me. And I wish that we could have one day a national holiday dedicated to him and also a statue in Washington. Because although he didn't change to the magnitude things that Dr. King did, he certainly made a great impact and left something behind and big shoes for other men to fill.
Yes.
Absolutely, Brittany, absolutely. He, like I said, he left an indelible mark on us as a people. I would be pretty amazed to know, what do you think Malcolm would think of his popularity? Matter of fact, I'll open this up to everybody. What do you think Malcolm would think of his popularity today in comparison to...
I don't think he'd care. I don't think he'd care. I would think he said I came and did what I do, but it's not surprising. I don't think he'd be surprised about it. It's not surprising. It's sad. This is still. It shows you that we still have a long way to go as a nation.
I think he's my gosh. He is so well rounded. Like you said, the parallels between his story and mine. He's such a well-rounded person, and I personally, I don't think he would be too receptive to his popularity. And what I mean by that is if you pay attention to him, he had such humility. He was so bipolar in a sense of how he was because his boldness, he still had humility, and he was oh, my gosh. It's hard to explain how, like I said, I mean, like you stated in his speeches, he always gave credit to everyone outside of himself. He understood who he was and where his gifts and stuff came from, and he had such humility. He never boasted, and he just was who he was, and he did what he did. And I get my boldness from him, my just audacity to just talk about something that does not go with what most people think, even though, and I just know that it's truth, and I'm willing to stand up for it. And I admire him, even in his death, the impact that he has in his, while he's gone in the physical sense on this earth, he's still just as impactful as he was living. And that just speaks to who he is. Based on who's speaking now, for the majority of us that are on this panel who are speaking right now, we represent the Christian faith. To take the time out to speak about a Muslim, and it speaks to our faith as well as to the power of who he was as a human being. And I really admire him and who he is, and his story really, really, like the young lady stated, resonates with mine and who I am. So
I think that Martin would have learned to respect and appreciate Malcolm, because keep in mind, they only met once and it was briefly. He knew of him as most people knew of him, and he didn't know him. They didn't get a chance to know one another. They didn't get a chance to understand that you're passive and passionate. I'm aggressive and passionate, and I'm just going to do this my way. If they would have had a chance to get to know one another, had those assassinations not happened, I see them melding together, each in respect one of the other. He just didn't know him. That's what it was. He didn't know him. And whereas, yes, Malcolm X, humble man, total humility, because he constantly reached out to Martin. I love Martin Luther King Jr., but he was stubborn. And it took too long for them to have that one brief meeting. And I honestly believe that from that one brief meeting,
had they survived, they would have been friends. And it would have been a joke sitting on a porch drinking lemonade about how I thought we were so different.
So?
Yeah. If I heard of that, my phone was on mute. Yo.
Okay.
Sorry.
As I'm looking at the time, and we're quickly approaching the witching hour, so to speak. I think I want all of us to just take a moment to reflect on what we feel on this day of reflection, the day of his assassination, what Brother Minister Shabazz's legacy is, not only to this generation, but to future generations. Brittany, you are our guest, so please share with us what you feel is his legacy.
Thank you. I feel Malcolm's legacy is to stand strong and to really stand up and be a man of your word, a man of character, and a man with a spine. I think he, again, you know, definitely should be a role model to our young black boys coming up behind him. Now they have rappers as role models. I love hip-hop. I'm not saying anything bad about it, but, you know, there was a generation that grew up with Malcolm as a role model. So we need to, you know, maybe increase our standards. And for me, being a young person, the legacy was, and the meaning is, to always stay strong and fight for what you believe in, even if demonize what you're saying, as long as you believe it's right in your heart and it's for good.
Absolutely. Brittany, we thank you very much for coming on. We thank you for sharing your opinion. We welcome you to call in at any time to share with us your thoughts and your views. Have a good evening, and thank you for calling once again.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
All right, ladies and gents, like I said, as it's like 10 minutes to go. Siggy, Malcolm's legacy, in your opinion? So you can hear me?
Sorry, I had my phone on mute. I apologize. Malcolm, I think we're all into the mute thing. Malcolm's legacy is his life. He still lives. His message is still powerful. I invite anybody to YouTube, and there's nothing more powerful than sit and listen to his speeches one after the other, and you realize that it hasn't stopped. His legacy continues. His daughter is seeing to it that his legacy continues, that his story is being told, that people need to understand that we need to go back, like Brittany said, to somewhere we can have better role models for our young boys. And we as parents, as mentors, as adults, as teachers, as leaders in our rights, our ways, our communities, and our lives, we owe it to them to have those conversations about Malcolm X. He's his legacy.
That's absolutely beautiful. It really is. Tom, legacy of Malcolm X.
All right, so for me, that legacy is a legacy about, you know, for me, I really think it's a transformation. You know, I really always loved the transformation of his life, and it was almost like a true story of, you know, maturing and of maturing to an idea, a way of living, and a lifestyle that, and a standard you set yourself to. and your community and the people around you. So I really believe that when you start with yourself and those around you, that's the beginning of how you make a real difference. You know, people will say what they want to say about him, but just, you know, that his, if they believed it, that he was inciting violence or inciting a change, as you know, people have their own ideas. But I think that when you take a look at what he actually stood for, the simple morals, that moral value of how you live your life, I think that's what he's going to be remembered for me.
That's right. That was absolutely great, Brad. That was good. Eddie, the legacy.
Boy. Hello. My.
Yes, sir.
His legacy. What is Malcolm X's legacy for me, or to me? Malcolm X's legacy to me, in the famous words of Malcolm X, would be, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And what I believe that he stood for was destroying stereotypes and challenging the status quo. That's pretty much what I think his legacy was. And I adopted that, and that is what I live by. Hell, that's tattooed on my body. If you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. And I had the audacity to adopt that and be bold enough to walk in it and bring it to fruition in hopes to bring or drag my generation along with me. So that's his legacy for me as a person and as a human being.
That's it, Eddie. That is it, Eddie. That's it. All right. My turn. The legacy of Elhaj Malik al-Shabazz, the legacy of Malcolm X, it lies in the future of our children. It lies when one day, whether it be our children or whether it be our grandchildren, when they look at themselves, what will they see? They will see a young man or a young woman. They will not, when they look at their hue and they look at their color, they appreciate the beauty that is within who they are, but they will not define themselves by it. They won't even fathom it being a source to define themselves by. It is a day when there will be no need for NAACP's or National Action Networks or Urban Leagues or any organizations for the sole purpose of making sure that human rights are human rights. The legacy of Malcolm X is where brothers of African descent truly love each other as brothers of African descent, not hating on you because, well, I'm an African American and you're either an island American or you are a true African from Africa looking down on those of us who were taken and separated from the continent. We are all brothers. We're all brothers of African descent, and to be able to have that pride of being brothers together, to be able to one day explore and to embrace what God has done for us and to recognize the white brother or the beige brother or the yellow brother also as a brother based upon how we deal with each other as human beings, not based upon what my color is. understanding that I am so much more than a hue. That's the legacy of Malcolm X to me. Malcolm stood for strength, determination. When I think of the word man up, if I think of a poster person, when I think of a male, that defines what a man is to me. El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, that's a man to me. And that's just my thought on what his legacy is. Well, y'all, this is it. We've had a I hope that we have shed light on this great man's life. I hope that we in our own small way have done justice in paying him tribute for his sacrifice, for the sacrifice of Betty Shabazz, for the sacrifice of his six children, thanking them for sharing his life and his legacy with the African-American community, the African community as a whole throughout the world and throughout the world itself. I would like to thank the Shabazz family so much for having sacrificed and given. I also would like to recommend to all who are in the New York metropolitan city area to go to 168th Street in Broadway. Go to the Malcolm X and Betty Shabazz Center and see American history, see where this man died, but his legacy continues to grow and flourish. And drop a couple of dollars in the plate to keep the place open in order for others to be able to come in and learn about our history, because it's so important to do so. I encourage everybody to do that. Well, ladies and gents, it's about that time. Closing thoughts. Siggy?
I want to encourage parents, teachers, mentors, community leaders to purchase the book Growing Up Malcolm X and Malcolm Little.
Malcolm Little, that's it.
The story of the man who became Malcolm X. Great reads and a lot of interesting information, and share it with the young people, not just the little boys, especially the little boys. Please share it with the little girls too.
Tom,
my closing remarks would be to make sure you always, you know, look at yourself and inward first. For me, that was, like I said, that was where I thought a lot of his message really came down to. You know, if you really want to make a change or things aren't going the way you want, let's look inward first. Make sure that we have our house together. That's
Michael. Eddie, come and give it to me.
Love yourselves. Realize that no matter what your situation, just like we just spoke about his story, no matter what your story is, you can still become and be something great. Just love yourselves. Love God, and be what God has intended for you to be through the gift that he's given you.
Absolutely wonderful group. Absolutely wonderful. This has been a Most Powerful Man Up show. I would like to thank all the listeners, all the callers. Billy from Orange, you didn't get to get on the line. I guess we got disconnected. Thank you for calling. I thank everybody for participating tonight. Remember, the struggle continues. Thank you, Brother Minister, for all that you've done. Ladies and gentlemen, we're off the air. Good night now. Good night, everybody.
Love you. Peace.
Playback.
Listen if you're missing, y'all.